Welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. That's John Coltrane. Well, the Kansas City Public Library and the Mid-Continent Public Library these days are focusing on a children's classic, Alice in Wonderland. It's all part of their first Great City, Great Read initiative that gives patrons a chance to connect with the book through lectures, youth programs, book discussions, film screenings, and a special art exhibit. So today we're going to take a look at some of these different ways of interpreting Alice in Wonderland, or Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, as it was originally titled. We'll talk about the book through the eyes of a screenwriter, a nationally recognized artist, and a nationally recognized jazz singer. But we begin with our buddy Katie Stover from the Kansas City Public Library, who's here to set the table for us here. And Katie, always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Always a pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
This book became a classic. Why?
Well, because it appeals to a great many readers. It's a children's classic. Teens love it and adults love it. The fantasy elements, the story, the storyline. It was a different kind of children's book when it was published because there isn't a straight narrative. It is just a series of vignettes. So for a lot of people, it was also rather confusing, and they wanted to know what's going to happen next. Is there going to be an end goal? And it was also different because Alice was never afraid and there was no moral to this story.
How popular does this book remain with your patrons coming into the library today?
Consistently.
Really?
This book's constantly checked out. We're always replacing it. We've already given away about 1,000 copies of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland across the city. And we have copies on the shelves and they're still checking out. Huh. It's going to be perennially popular. I am told it is the third most quoted book in literature, right after the Bible and Shakespeare.
Wow. Well, what do we know about Lewis Carroll, the author, or what he was trying to achieve here, Katie, or should I say what Charles Lutwidge Dodgson, if I'm saying that right, was trying to achieve here, because Lewis Carroll was his pen name.
Yes, it was. Dodgson started telling this story, legend has it, in a boat ride to these three little girls. Now, what we need to remember is that in that boat were not just the three little girls of varying ages. One was 6, one was 10, and one was 13. There was an adult, an older adult, someone older than Dodgson. So as he's spinning this story, he has to keep in mind how many people he's entertaining. Mm-hmm. So if the story resonates with children for the fantasy elements, it's because he had a 6-year-old in the boat. It resonates for teenagers. He had a 13-year-old. And it resonates for adults because he had someone over 40 in the boat with him as well.
And you can't help but wonder and imagine, what would he think if he was sitting with us here today about all of you being here and all the attention this book is still getting?
I am certain he didn't think he was spinning a yarn that would be a classic at the time he told the story to the children. That no author never thinks that they're writing a bestseller for the ages at the time they're writing it.
Katie, just a final point. How good of a book is it? How well written is it? How imaginative from a critical standpoint?
Extremely imaginative and very elegantly written. It functions on many different levels. You can read it as just a literary children's classic. You can read it just for the fantastical elements on the surface. There are people that are still finding elements in this book to write papers and do research on. They're looking for elements of Dodgson's life in this book. And yes, there's some folks that like to look for the drug references. No, they're not there.
They really aren't.
No, they're not.
Yeah. Okay. People think otherwise.
Because it's fun to do so, and some folks need tenure.
Yeah. That's Katie Stover from the Kansas City Public Library. Katie, thank you very much. Well, let's bring Mitch Bryan into our conversation now. He's one of our video gurus who's going to trace the book's history in film and how Hollywood has adapted Alice's themes. And Mitch Bryan is a screenwriter and a UMKC film prof. And Mitch, how are you?
I'm great. It's good to be here.
How often has Hollywood turned to Alice in Wonderland for inspiration over the years, Mitch?
Filmmakers, not just Hollywood, have been turning to it for, there's at least, you know, a couple dozen versions, maybe more, because there's Japanese versions and there's Czech versions and there's Russian versions and television versions and movie versions. And then there's also plays. So it's a well that is constantly, everybody's going back and dipping into it again and again, because it, as Katie was saying, it offers so many ways to interpret the piece, you know?
I was going to say, it lends itself so well because people, see different things in this thing? Or?
Yeah, and depending on how shrewd the producer is, there's also lots of opportunities for stars. So when Irwin Allen, the producer of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and The Towering Inferno and Earthquake decided to do his version, he immediately went for the possibilities of getting all these different actors to come in, and each one comes in and they're in the particular vignette, and then you half the time you don't see him again. Mm-hmm. So it's a great opportunity for cameos.
Huh. Well, is it fair to say that the book opens the door to what? Imaginations run wild.
Well, sure. And Tim Burton's most recent version, which was this kind of reimagining of it where Alice goes back to Wonderland not remembering she'd been there before and eventually becomes involved with the politics of Wonderland and ends up fighting a dragon in armor like Joan of Arc. And the movie is this huge blockbuster because it offers all of these potential spectacle moments, you know.
Yeah. You brought some clips with you this morning.
Yeah. I wanted to start with what's my favorite version, which was a version that was made in 1966 for BBC. And it sort of goes against all what we would expect. It's done in Victorian dress. It's done in black and white. Hmm. No crazy animal heads. The actors and a huge cast, Michael Redgrave and John Gielgud, are all playing it very sort of, it's a satire. It's mm-hmm. very melancholy. Miller himself said that he felt like it was always about growing up and how tough it is to grow up and not knowing how the rules work and this confusion of Alice. So I have a clip where Michael Redgrave is playing the caterpillar, and it takes place in this paneled museum-like room, and he's asked Alice to recite one of the poems, and there's this real sense of melancholy and solemnity. It sure isn't Walt Disney, that's for sure.
Let's listen.
"You are old," said the youth, "and your jaws are too weak for anything tougher than suet. Do you think I can listen all day to such stuff? Be off, or I'll kick you downstairs."
"That's not quite right."
"I'm afraid some of the words seem to have got altered."
"Oh, is it wrong from beginning to end? What size do you want to be?"
"I'm not particular as to size. It's just that one doesn't like changing so often, you know."
"No, I don't know. Are you happy now?"
"Well, I'd like to be a little larger."
"Hmm. Seems a very nice size to me."
"But I'm not used to it."
"Hmm. You'll get used to it in time."
Well, you're right. That's a very different tone than what we're used to seeing most days here when it comes to Alice in Wonderland.
But the wordplay is still there, which is another thing that's so appealing about it. It's about language, and it's open to many different kinds of interpretation. And that certainly is a version that took a very specific take and went in one direction with it, and it makes it really different.
What's your second clip here?
And then the other thing about Alice in Wonderland is that you can't draw a firm number for how many versions because it's constantly influencing other movies. So in 1980, Richard Rush made a film called The Stuntman, which is about a convict who is on the run and who ends up hiding out with a movie company. And he becomes like Alice, not sure where to turn and who are his friends and who are his enemies. And he's being manipulated by this director played by Peter O'Toole. And like so many movies, all you have to do is reference Alice in Wonderland like a touchstone. And the audience goes, "Oh, I know what that story is. Even if I haven't read it, I know enough about Alice mm-hmm. in Wonderland to kind of know mm-hmm. what the paradigm is."
And the clip here is...
So this is when he just got the job and is being allowed to hide out with... And the director is telling him how this is going to work.
"And the part is yours."
"What? What are you talking about? What part?"
"The stuntman."
"What about the people that work for you? Are they gonna look at me and go, 'Hi, Burke'?"
"You prefer 'Hi, Alice'? Don't worry about the people who work for me, my crew. They'll call you anything I wish them to. And I'm not being callous, merely. Bert is a bloody tragedy, but there's nothing I can do about it. Nothing. I must have this location for 3 days, and you need a place to hide."
"Eli, the crew's waiting. We need the next setup."
"The hand! Close up of the hand! With you in a minute!"
"An Eli minute or a real minute?"
"By tomorrow, the cops are going to know exactly what I look like."
"Do stop this worrying. You must have heard surely of movie magic. You shall be a stuntman who is an actor, who is a character in a movie, who is an enemy soldier, who look for you amongst all those People like to believe in things, and policemen are just people. Also, I'm told. Frankly, our problem is so simple, it's almost beneath us. Now, listen to me. That door is the looking glass, and inside it is Wonderland. Have faith, Alice. Close your eyes and enjoy.
That's from The Stuntman. I guess it's fair to say, Mitch, that Hollywood screenwriters, producers will be coming up with more interpretations of Alice in Wonderland for a long time to come.
And a big sequel to Tim Burton's blockbuster coming next year.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. That's screenwriter Mitch Bryan. Mitch, always good to have you here.
Thanks.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about how people interpret Alice in Wonderland just in time for the Kansas City Public Library, the Mid-Continent Public Library's Great City, Great Read initiative that's going on right now, all focused on the classic Alice in Wonderland. Now joining us is Angela Hagenbach, the jazz singer who's so beloved around town and is involved in a most unique retelling of Alice's adventures in Wonderland. And Angela, so good to have you here again.
It's
welcome back.
It's great to be back.
Thank you. I love what you've done here because you've written a story that I just love this. Hang on here, folks, that makes Alice a student of jazz studies in the free-spirited 1960s and pairs the music of John Coltrane, we just heard his music a few minutes ago, with original lyrics inspired by Lewis Carroll's classic novel. I mean, wow, where did the idea for all this come from? In that head right there I'm looking at right now?
Yeah. Well, I was presented with an opportunity from Katie to pursue this, and well, not pursue the Coltrane part, but to create a sort of a musical component to the the 6 or 7 week long
great celebration.
Yeah, 150th year. Yeah. And so when I get home, you know, I'd been binge listening to Coltrane, which I tend to do to a lot of my favorite artists. Mm-hmm. And at this particular time, it was Coltrane. And so I get home, I'm like, okay, so what just happened? Because I was, I had another thing in mind when I went to see Katie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not this.
Imagine that, Angela. Yeah.
And so while I was listening and pondering, okay, how can I bring a musical component to this story? Saida's Song Flute was on, which is one of Coltrane's pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And as the music started, I heard and saw the rabbit hopping into her dream. And so I stopped what I was doing, and I immediately went down to my workspace at home, and I laid out three songs, boom, 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 just like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I was inspired. I've been a fan of the story for many years,
mm-hmm.
and I'm already a Coltrane fan, and those three songs came immediately. It was like the first, second, and third song of the play. And, of course, then I hit a roadblock for a while, but I was immersing myself in the materials, and I'd already had been immersed in Coltrane, and I sort of ventured off. I listened to some Alice Coltrane. I'm like, oh, that might be cool, but mm-hmm. it kind of didn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that moment, I decided, okay, this is going to be a completely John Coltrane salute, as well as to the Alice in Wonderland.
So once again, John Coltrane's at the root of something special here.
Yes, well, you know, this was his phase, 1957 through 1960, where he was sort of experimenting with modal mm-hmm. music, modal jazz,
mm-hmm.
and it's very mathematical. There's a constant flux of key signatures, or the keys changing within a single composition, sometimes within a phrase.
Mm.
So nothing is consistent in the path of the music the compositions that he's writing. So very similar to Lewis Carroll.
Yeah.
You know, one minute you think the story's going this way, and flop, it flips right over, and it's another completely different area in the story. And so in that way, they work very, very well together. You know, of course, Carroll was a mathematician.
Yeah.
And for me, I can feel the meter of his writing, you know.
Yeah.
So, and so it just sort of lined up very well with the songs that I selected.
What's the clip you brought with us here?
Well, I've got
Spiral. It's called Spiral.
Okay, Spiral. Okay, well, Spiral is the song that's going to segue between all the scenes.
Let's get a little taste of it here. You'll have several opportunities to hear Angela Hagenbach's Jazz Alice Wednesday, 6:30, October 28th at the Plaza Branch. It's almost at capacity, so a second show has been added Monday, November 2nd at the Plaza Branch. The Mid-Continent Public Library hosts a performance on November 10th at the Pavilion at John Knox Village in Lee Summit. Go to the library's website for more information. And Angela, good to have you. Thanks so much for the update.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Appreciate it. And now we're joined by the internationally recognized Kansas City artist Peregrine Honig, who will discuss the fascination that Alice holds for artists and the many ways they find inspiration in her encounters with the characters and curiosities of Wonderland. Peregrine Honig has curated an exhibit, Intimate Riot, that offers viewers a sense of psychedelic discovery and bewilderment akin to Alice's dreams and conflicts in the book. It features the work of an acclaimed collective of award-winning artists and fashion designers. And Peregrine, nice to have you here. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So same question I asked Angela, to what extent does Alice in Wonderland open up the throttles of an artist's imagination here?
Well, I think every artist that I know has probably encountered the ideas of Alice in Wonderland, this way of transcending into space or feeling uncomfortable in your skin or going through any sort of change when it comes to making or doing or being. And so similar to Angela, when Katie approached me, I was really excited and had not as quality of an idea as I came to next.
Yeah.
And so I have to be thankful that I was working with such a group of consummate professionals. It's just been such a delight to work with the library. And so I really love this idea of, well, who would Alice be after having gone through this crazy experience? Mm-hmm. And who would Alice be if she were a contemporary art collector, right?
Of course.
You know, she would definitely be eccentric. She was this wealthy, you know, English girl. And I asked the library to help me pull together some of my favorite artists, Barry Anderson, Marcus Kane, Kate Clements, Will Cotton, Laura DeAngelis, Leo Esquivel, David Ford, Satch Hoyt, Hadley and Johnson, Sally Mann and Erica Vetch. And it was this sort of 11 artists and 13 pieces, not too many pieces, mm-hmm. but enough that you could sort of walk through and feel like you're having a personal experience with these different artists' objects.
Yeah.
And I was so lucky that I was working with a group of people who were willing to put names on a postcard before we were 110% sure that we had those artists.
Yeah.
Like, not kidding. There were hours between, like, proving publication and then getting the email that, yes, indeed, we had the two Sally Mann pieces.
Yeah.
So Sally Mann is one of my favorite photographers, and there are two incredible pieces up at the library. And if you haven't encountered her work, there are two photographs of her children, and they're in this very sort of southern scape and very natural and very dark and very beautiful. And her relationship with her children and her camera is very poetic.
Yeah.
So in this process, I really wanted a lot of the pieces to feel like you were looking into something or you were moving through space as Alice.
Ah.
And so with Hadley and Johnson's work, I wanted it to sort of be this historical objects that Alice might have worn. And with Erica's work, I wanted them to be jewelry that she might have encountered and owned, almost like Peggy Guggenheim, like some eccentric woman who had a really strange taste because of her life experiences.
Well, my goodness. Well, Peregrine Honig's Intimate Riot is on display through January 17th at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. Again, that's at 14 West 10th Street. And Peregrine, thanks for the update. Sounds spectacular.
Stop by
and see it.